Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's Reagan Forum, we go back a few weeks to our virtual program with Mark Updegrove. Mark is the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and serves as presidential historian for ABC News. Mark joined us to discuss his brand new book, Incomparable Grace, JFK and the Presidency, an illuminating account of John F. Kennedy's brief but transformative tenure in the White House. During our Reagan Forum, Mark sat down in conversation with the Reagan Foundation and Institute's chief learning officer, Tony Penny. Let's listen.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Tony Penny, and I'm the chief learning officer here at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. I'm very excited today for our guest who's going to be joining us, Mark Updegrove from the LBJ Foundation down in Austin, Texas, one of our Presidential Foundation brothers, coming out with a new book, and very excited to talk about that today. So welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Tony. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Well, before we jump into the book, I want to get a little bit of background. I want to hear a little bit of your origin story. As you know, at the presidential libraries, where we always like to tell the origin story first before you get into the meat and potatoes, right? So if you could just start off by telling our audience what it was that initially drew you to the concept and the history of the presidency.
You know, I had a very different career. I had a high-flying career in media, but on the business side, I had been the head of Time's Los Angeles office, and then that led to a promotion to become the president of Time Canada, Time's independent operation and edition north of the border. That led to me being publisher of Newsweek, and then to a job at MTV, which didn't satisfy me particularly. And in order to retain my sanity and self-respect, I started writing a book called Second Acts, Presidential Lives and Legacies After the White House, which tracks the post-presidential lives of every president from Truman through Clinton. It was published in 2006. Our most recent former president was Bill Clinton. And included in that was a wonderful exploration of Ronald Reagan's post-presidency. The book did well and led to another book, which led to conversations with the LBJ, or make that the National Archives, about the possibility of running a presidential library. And the one that I was really interested in was the LBJ Presidential Library.
And what was it about the LBJ Library in particular that drew you there?
You know, Tony, it was a number of things. Number one, I thought that President Johnson had been given short shrift in terms of the way that we evaluated his legacy. He was thought of as the Vietnam president, and Vietnam is certainly a very important part of the LBJ legacy. It's a rightful part of his legacy. And as we know, looking back, he made a lot of erroneous decisions relating to Vietnam, not just LBJ, significantly JFK and Nixon and Ford to a certain degree, but most of the responsibility, and I think this is rightful too, was pinned on LBJ. But in focusing solely on Vietnam, I think we lost sight of the greater part of the LBJ presidency, which were the laws of the Great Society, in particular, those relating to civil rights. And one of our most sacred creeds is all men are created equal, but at least all men in this country were not created equal under the law until the civil rights laws that LBJ signed during the course of his very eventful presidency.
Excellent. Yeah. So obviously you're there at the LBJ Library. You're thinking about legacy. And is that one so you've written the book about the post-presidency. I know you've written at least a couple other books on the presidency as well, right? How do you go through the process of choosing which topics you want to write about?
You know, there's the old expression, write the book you want to read. And so I've always written the books that I really wanted to read, that I thought filled a niche. And that was certainly true with the first one, Second Acts. I hadn't read a comprehensive history of the modern presidents in the post-presidency. And what those years, those very eventful years in the life of a president mean to his legacy, how they reflect the character of that president and how their legacies are formed during those years. So that was one I thought that needed to be written. And that was true with my most recent book, Incomparable Grace, JFK and the Presidency, which of course we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, well, and I'm interested too, you know, so when you get into the idea, anytime you choose to write a book, right, I think there has to be a couple of questions you have to answer. Why this topic? And it sounds like you've answered that a little bit, which is you wanted to write a book you wanted to read. And why now? So I'd love for you to just tell us a little bit about why you wanted to write this book and why it was top of your mind at the present moment.
You know, it takes a long time for us to look dispassionately at a president's legacy. That was certainly true with Lyndon Johnson, as I mentioned earlier, and it's true for John F. Kennedy, too. John F. Kennedy left office sort of martyred, having been assassinated in Dallas in November of 1963. And then we got the Camelot myths around JFK. And then there was sort of correctionism, this revisionist history on JFK, which was far more negative. But we're now two generations away from the presidency of John F. Kennedy. And it gives us an opportunity for greater, I think, greater objectivity, greater dispassion in evaluating his legacy. I also really wanted to look at this really consequential presidency and why it matters 60 years on. It's also fascinating to look at a Me Too era president in the age of, in the eyes of 2022. This was a very different generation. And we've had a lot of movements spring up since the presidency of John F. Kennedy. So I thought it was really important to take a look at his presidency with a modern eye.
Yeah, yeah, it's fascinating. You know, there's a lot of things as I was reading through the book, and it's a great book, by the way, and it's coming out in April, correct? I want to make sure so that we can encourage all of our watchers to go out and purchase a copy, but it comes out in April, is that right?
That's right, end of next month, Tony.
End of next month. So fantastic. I was grateful for a copy to get a chance to read it ahead. But yeah, I mean, one of the things we think about with presidential legacy is that idea that each presidential legacy is always constantly going through a process of reinterpretation, right? Every decade or generation or so has a different interpretation. That's why, you know, Abraham Lincoln, 16,000 books about him, right? We are constantly reinterpreting the legacy of our most consequential presidents. And as you point out at the end of your book, when historians look at John F. Kennedy, he's certainly up there, right? He's certainly kind of historically ranked very strongly in terms of his communication skills, in terms of what he was able to accomplish. A little bit of a rarity for a president who was in office, obviously tragically cut short by the assassination, but to have done so much in so little time. What do you think is some of the magic? Why is it that JFK still holds such a place in the American imagination?
You know, that's part of this, Tony, looking at why he's still, his image is so enduring. I think it's several things. And I think Ronald Reagan shares some of these qualities. First of all, he is incredibly telegenic in a time when television was vitally important to a politician's trajectory. And John F. Kennedy sort of ushers in the television era for the presidency. And he has this incredibly captivating, glamorous, elegant image. That's one thing. Two, again, like Ronald Reagan, this soaring rhetoric that gets us to look beyond ourselves as a nation and defines who we are at that point in time. Both of those things hold up well in history. That imagery, that rhetoric holds up so well, which is why we regard him better than we might say a president like Lyndon Johnson, who did so much prodigiously legislatively. But yet it's not that front and center. It's not, it doesn't capture our imagination in the same manner that imagery does or rhetoric does. So I think that's part of it. And part of it is that he's a pretty darn good president who starts off a little shaky in the job, learns from his mistakes, and ends up having a very consequential effect on America and the world.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a second and kind of come back to that idea of stumbling kind of out of the blocks of his presidency. I think you make a case for how he did that with Khrushchev and with the Bay of Pigs and that sort of thing. But I want to go back even farther and kind of look at the roots of who JFK was as a person and in his path to the presidency, which is fascinating, right? I feel like in the story of the American presidency writ large, it seems like there's two kind of major captivating narratives. One is the Lincoln narrative, let's say, of the self-made kind of, you know, American plainsman came from almost nothing and rose to the heights in the most powerful office in the land. And then the other, which is, let's say Kennedy, Roosevelt, that sort of thing, where they were born into some pretty tremendous wealth and advantages and had a path and ended up being just as consequential. But it wasn't really... I mean, for JFK, his family, and obviously his father is a really compelling figure in the story of JFK and the designs that he has for his children in terms of political success. But initially, it wasn't JFK who he envisioned as rising to the president, right?
You know, there's a chapter in my book that gives the backstory of John F. Kennedy called The Second Son. And you're quite right. Joe Kennedy thought his son would become president of the United States. That was his ambition, not only to rise himself in the world, but to be in a position to see his son become president of the United States, not just president of the United States, but the first Catholic of the Catholic president of the United States at a time when there was still great prejudice around Catholicism. But the person he envisioned taking the presidency on behalf of the family was Joe Kennedy, his namesake, who would end up dying tragically in World War II. So then Joe Kennedy's lofty ambitions were focused on his second son, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was not quite as auspicious, let's say, as his older brother, but ends up obviously rising to the task, rising to the challenge of not only gaining political office, but rising the ranks in order to become the 35th president of the United States.
Yeah, no, it was fascinating to see that, and fascinating, I mean, his path to the presidency, where he came from this family, they had the political pull, he was able to, you know, get to elected office first in Congress and then the Senate. And you point out in your book that his career in both of those houses was remarkably undistinguished for someone who aspired for a higher office, right?
He was always looking ahead, right? Those were just stepping stones for the presidency. And it would have been easy to write off John F. Kennedy at a certain point as a dilettante, as a backbencher in the Senate who simply wanted to be president but didn't necessarily have the political skill and the overall abilities to do so. But he ends up running an incredibly effective presidential campaign in 1960. And again, capturing the imagination of the American people and overcoming some obstacles along the way, notably the fact that he was Catholic, as I mentioned earlier, which really mattered to Americans at that point. Was he going to serve the Pope or was he going to serve the American people? That's remarkable to think about in retrospect, but it was a real issue at the time. He also battled some of the party elders who didn't think he was ready to be president. They thought he was callow. Among them was Harry Truman. And John F. Kennedy effectively addressed that issue, went on to run a very effective campaign against a formidable candidate in Richard Nixon, who himself was a very young and aspiring politician, having been a congressman and senator himself before becoming vice president to Dwight Eisenhower. John F. Kennedy, however, in the debates, seems to do a better job, partly because of the imagery I mentioned. There are those famous debates between Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy, the first presidential debates we have ever had as a nation. No two candidates had squared off against each other in a debate. And one of the reasons that John F. Kennedy wins is because he just looks better on camera. He's far more telegenic than the pallid Richard Nixon, who is, has a 5 o'clock shadow and just doesn't come off particularly well. But if you listen to those, to the substance of the debate, the candidates are remarkably similar on the issue. So John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan, to an extent, are perfect examples of how image matters in the presidency.
Yeah, that is a pretty big shift in the way that presidents use, or that mass communication plays a role in the presidency, right? If you look through the history of the country, in the early days, we had the printing press. And, you know, if George Washington writes his farewell letter, and it takes weeks at some points for it to get out to different parts of the country, Abe Lincoln with his speaking, you know, FDR, obviously, with the radio, and JFK, really the pioneer in using television effectively. In fact, you point out, you think about some of these, the presidents who have the reputation as being the very highest level of presidential communication. Certainly JFK is among them, Lincoln, Roosevelt, Reagan, those sorts of things. He used TV in a different way to reach out to the American people, right? You talk a little bit in the book about some of his Oval Office addresses and how he used that to his advantage, both to kind of garner public support and legislatively as well.
You know, that's exactly right, Tony. And if you look at the great politicians of our times, they're the great communicators. And the great communicators understand how to harness the power of the mediums of their time. So for Thomas Jefferson, it was partisan newspapers. Abraham Lincoln understood the fledgling art of photography and how that could help his campaign. So he understands how icons, pictures of him, can boost his presidency. Of course, Franklin Roosevelt understood the power of radio, using it through the course of his incredibly important presidency in the depths of the Depression, with the fireside chats, talking to the American people as though he was in their living room, which was incredibly effective. And then you get John F. Kennedy understanding the power of television. Of course, President Reagan did so as well, used the medium masterfully to get their message through. You could say the same thing about Donald Trump and Twitter. He understood the power of social media and harnessed it to get his message directly out to the American people.
Yeah, and we see this, I mean, pretty pressingly. So we talked a little bit about the election, and he narrowly beats out Nixon, one of the closer elections in American history, but he wins by, 118,000 votes or so, roughly, takes office, and his inaugural address, his kind of introduction to the country and his outlaying of his vision, arguably one of the most powerful and insightful and probably quoted inaugural addresses in American history. What's your assessment of the way he initially takes the presidential stage?
You know, it's really interesting because, as you mentioned, he wins the presidency in a whisper. You know, it's less than 0.1% of the American vote that gives the presidency to John F. Kennedy over Richard Nixon. So a very narrow margin with some voting irregularities both in Illinois and in Texas. Richard Nixon concedes the election. John F. Kennedy goes on to the presidency and of course makes that searing inaugural address. And I keep on using the phrase, he captured the imagination of the American people, but that is certainly true with his inaugural address. And to a certain extent, he captures the imagination of the world. There's wide praise for his address going forward. And again, it gets Americans thinking about something beyond themselves. The most famous line of that address is, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And that fires the imagination of so many people throughout our nation, including those on the front lines of the civil rights movement, which was one of the themes of the book, how John F. Kennedy faces that as one of the crises in his presidency. But it's very telling, given the fact that there's this incredibly narrow victory in the presidency, that shortly into his tenure in office, after he suffers the Bay of Pigs crisis, this failed incursion of Cuba to oust Fidel Castro, the dictator of Fidel Castro, his approval rating is an astounding 83%. He has the American people rallied around him such that even when he fails, shortly into the course of his, at that point, very turbulent presidency, the American people are behind him. He would never see his approval rating go above 83%. So Americans were united in supporting this young, callow, but aspiring president.
Yeah, it was amazing when I read that and thinking about the way that presidential polling looks now, right? I mean, if you're doing a good job as president, you might get in the 50s, right? It seems like in the present day, and at any given moment, at least half the country is going to disapprove of what you're doing. And here, post Bay of Pigs, you know, JFK had failed pretty embarrassingly on a national and international stage. But it was interesting to see that he was not afraid to take responsibility for that. You know, if you look at his remarks afterwards, and you pointed out that he didn't try to point the blame and blame his advisors or anything, even as a young, relatively inexperienced president, he accepted responsibility. Do you think that's one of the things that endeared him to the American people?
I think it probably helped at that moment in time. One of the things he says, as you know, is, a good idea has many fathers, but a bad idea is an orphan. But at the end of the day, like Harry Truman, he told the American people that the buck stopped with him. And in taking responsibility, I think Americans were willing to forgive him. And that's really essential in him going forward in his presidency. As you know, from having read the book, Tony, there are a couple of other stumbles that he makes, and it emboldens his Soviet adversary, Nikita Khrushchev, and leads to one of the most dangerous moments in humankind with the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah. Well, you also talked about, you know, him meeting up with Khrushchev in Vienna and Khrushchev essentially kind of running over him, right? And some of the criticisms that Kennedy faced. And you talk about how President Eisenhower was worried that, you know, they were electing essentially a schoolboy to come in and try and deal with these tough Russians. And at first, especially in that first year of his presidency, it looked like they were right about him, right? That he might not be up to the task of managing, this massive kind of existential threat in Soviet Russia.
That's exactly right. And I, as you know, I start the book with this vignette after this summit that the entire world is watching. Almost, it's like two heavyweights having a bout over the heavyweight crown. You've got the Soviet leader and the American leader talking at a time when the Cold War was at its height. And after these series of meetings where he gets, I just, routed by Nikita Khrushchev, he goes back to the U.S. Embassy in Vienna, and he has this incredibly frank conversation with Scotty Reston from the New York Times. And he admits to being savaged, those are his words, savaged by Nikita Khrushchev. And he realizes that as long as Khrushchev has this image of him as weak and ineffective, it's going to embolden Khrushchev. So John F. Kennedy sees this coming after this poor performance in Vienna. And he says, until we remove these ideas, Nikita Khrushchev is going to be dangerous. And again, that leads to, I think, the very dangerous ambitions of Nikita Khrushchev shipping nuclear arms to Cuba, just 90 miles away from American shores.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you talk about the title, and this is one of the places where I really see the title coming through and the grace of Kennedy, you know, you mentioned that he really lost faith with some of his military advisors during the Bay of Pigs. And as he gets closer and he's getting a lot of advice, it seems like during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that the solution is to go in and invade Cuba and put a stop to it. He's almost on an island where he is determined to have a peaceful solution. And he insists on this blockade. But it becomes one of the most tense moments in the 20th century and in the history of our country, where if the wrong set of circumstances happens, it's over, right? This Cold War becomes a very, very hot war. I'd love your insights on how, as a relatively inexperienced president, as a president who's taken his licks in the first couple of interactions with the Soviet Union and Cuba, what is it about those 13 days that really elevate him into the pantheon? I think you could argue that it's one of the most successful navigations of a crisis in American history.
And to your point, perhaps the most dangerous moment in all of human history, because the two leaders came so close to pushing the button, so close to escalating World War III. I think what captures Kennedy in those moments is, as you pointed out, he realizes he's been misled by his military with the Bay of Pigs fiasco, and that they are jingoist. They are looking for military engagement. They're not being cool-headed about this crisis. That's what that captures Kennedy. I think what I argue in my book is that the incomparable grace of John F. Kennedy happens in his early in his presidency, almost for superficial reasons. I mentioned that glamorous image that he casts, as well as the memorable rhetoric of his inauguration. But it's on the surface. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, we really see how deep that grace is. And his equanimity makes all the difference in the world. He doesn't do anything rash. He ensures that he's keeping close counsel with those around him, that he's keeping his options open, and that he's making the right decisions. Nothing impetuous, nothing rash, nothing draconian. He's also aware that he needs to allow Khrushchev to save face in some manner. I mean, these are all lessons perhaps for Joe Biden as he stares down his Russian adversary in Vladimir Putin at another very dangerous moment in the course of our history.
More from our Reagan Forum with Mark Updegrove after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now back to our Reagan Forum with Mark Updegrove.
Yeah, do you think it would, I mean, would you advise the current president to read through Kennedy's navigation of the Cuban Missile Crisis for kind of a North Star as to how to navigate, obviously, a geopolitical situation that gets increasingly tense with every day?
Yeah, I think that Kennedy's leadership in that moment is exemplary. It keeps us out of this conflict. One of the things that you'll read in the book is that there's this back channel communication with the Soviet embassy that allows them a solution to this crisis. One of the things that the American people or the citizens of the world did not know when Khrushchev eventually relented and you had those ships going back to the Soviet Union with the nuclear arms they had hoped to plant on the ground in Cuba, is that we made a deal to remove obsolete nuclear missiles from Turkey. We were going to remove them anyway, so this was an easy concession to make. But the Soviets rightfully believed that, hey, look, if you're going to have missiles in our backyard, we're going to have missiles in yours, right? There was the MAD theory, mutually assured destruction. And the Soviets wanted to make sure they had as much of an advantage in terms of nuclear weaponry as we did. So we said that we would quietly, within the next 6 months, after the crisis was over, remove those missiles from Turkey. And in fact, that's exactly what we did.
Yeah, what another thing that I thought was really interesting was the way, and you write about this a little bit, is the way in which Kennedy would turn to some of the former presidents for advice and counsel and kind of run some of his ideas by him. What is this, as somebody who studied the presidency pretty successfully, the reliance that a current in-office president might have on a former president? What did you see there?
You know, one of those moments is after the Bay of Pigs. So Kennedy takes office 3 months later. He stumbles his toe with the Bay of Pigs. It's this enormously botched operation, as I mentioned earlier. And one of the first things he does is goes to Camp David and meets with Dwight Eisenhower. And Eisenhower sort of privately takes him to the woodshed for doing something so foolish, though Eisenhower advocated the plan in some form during the transition. But publicly, he puts his arm around Kennedy and says he supports him in the job. And that's really important at that moment. That's important for the American people to see that that Kennedy's predecessor, the very respected hero of D-Day, Dwight Eisenhower, would stand behind the president at this moment in time. It's also important for the world to see, because during Ike's very successful two-year presidency, he kept the Soviet wolf at bay, partly because the Soviets didn't have the impression of him as being callow and inexperienced as they did of John F. Kennedy. So that was important for the world to see that we were all united together in this and that Kennedy was keeping the counsel of the redoubtable Dwight Eisenhower.
Yeah, I want to shift a little bit domestically too, right? So this is, you know, when you come in, it's a very bleak time foreign policy wise. That, you know, the height of the Cold War. He successfully navigates the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it's not all kind of roses and easiness for JFK after that. On the domestic front, at the same time, you have the civil rights movement going on, and it's really interesting how you chart. He shifts over time his position during the civil rights movement. It seems like at first he almost sees it as something he doesn't want to deal with. He'd rather ignore it and not focus on it because he doesn't see it as a political win. But his feeling towards it over time seems to shift, right?
Exactly right. And you see in this a reflection of what social movements can do to move political agendas. I don't think we have civil rights, but for the civil rights campaign of Martin Luther King and these direct action campaigns in various places that show the American people virulent prejudice and bigotry and what Jim Crow looks like essentially to those people of color living in the South. So there are a number of campaigns that occur. We have the Freedom Riders riding through the Deep South on buses, Capitol Trailways, and Greyhound buses throughout the course of the spring and summer of 1961, trying to integrate buses at that time and meeting with fierce resistance by bigots and others who were resisting integration. And John F. Kennedy reacts to that. We then have James Meredith trying to enroll, which he was able to do legally, at the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, and the resistance that comes there. And then we have the civil rights campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, and the governor of Alabama, George Wallace, standing in the doorway to prevent integration at the University of Alabama. All this stuff is pushing Kennedy further and further to take real action, substantive action on civil rights, which ultimately he does.
Yeah. And so that kind of, and then, I mean, that in some ways leads us, you know, his unfinished. He starts to look forward to running for re-election, right? He's immensely popular. If you look at the popularity numbers for JFK throughout his presidency, and especially at the peaks, I think the only comparable kind of modern president might be George W. Bush post 9/11, where his popularity numbers were extremely high. It seems like he's a shoo-in to win re-election, right? There's a couple of, you go through, he's kind of assessing the different candidates who might run against him on the Republican side and his chances, and he was hopeful that Barry Goldwater would be his opponent if he ran. But he was thinking a little bit, you mentioned the, and the place where you are at, Lyndon Johnson, his vice president, right? Talk a little bit about Lyndon Johnson in the Kennedy administration, because he had kind of a unique position, right?
Yeah, without question. It was a different time for the vice presidency, honestly. Vice presidents were so marginalized at that time. The Kennedys, I think, chose Lyndon Johnson to balance the ticket. They needed a strong presence in the South. Lyndon Johnson had, like John F. Kennedy, come to Congress at the age of 29. He rose the ranks to the Senate and became the most perhaps effective Senate majority leader in the history of our country. This was somebody who was formidable, who thought he should have the presidency himself, not the inexperienced dilettante John F. Kennedy. But he accepts the vice presidency when it's clear that the nomination is going to John F. Kennedy. Why he does so is not quite clear, but he says it's because, you know, a quarter of our presidents to that point had died in office. So it was the only chance he would get to rise the ranks and become the president of the United States himself. But I think it was more because he realized that if Nixon had become president, he would not have been as effective as majority leader. And the only way that Kennedy could become president is with that regional balance, having a strong presence in the South to ensure his victory. And if you look at those tight numbers that I mentioned earlier, Tony, there's no question in my mind that's true. You needed somebody with Southern bona fides in order to balance that ticket. That's what rides John F. Kennedy into the White House. But at the same time, it leads to a couple of years of real misery for Lyndon Johnson, who was such a creature of power.
He was, and it seems especially he and JFK didn't butt heads quite as much as he and Bobby Kennedy. They seem to be just at complete odds against each other within the administration, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. We tend to think of the Kennedys monolithically, but they all thought differently about Lyndon Johnson. Joe Kennedy, the Kennedy patriarch, was a huge fan of Lyndon Johnson. The only way he thought his son should accept the vice presidency, if it were offered to him in 1956, was if the presidential nominee for the Democrats was Lyndon Johnson. He even offered to finance the campaign. Ted Kennedy was a big fan of Lyndon Johnson. Bobby Kennedy, on the other hand, was not a fan. And that was that mutual contempt was reciprocated by Lyndon Johnson. The two were just fundamentally opposed to one another. John F. Kennedy was somewhere in the middle. I think he had enormous respect for Lyndon Johnson. Every time John F. Kennedy wanted to do something as senator of Massachusetts, when the two were in the upper chamber of Congress, he had to go hat in hand to Lyndon Johnson, who would make it happen. So he understood that Lyndon Johnson knew political power and had great respect for them. But again, like Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Kennedy, there were enormous differences between Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy.
Yeah, and Johnson was not really, I mean, if you think about, you know, Truman, when he was vice president to Roosevelt, and he assumes the presidency after Roosevelt dies and doesn't even know about the Manhattan Project, right? I mean, was Lyndon Johnson that far away, or it seemed like he was a little bit closer than maybe the Truman vice presidency?
You know, Truman was vice president for such a short period of time, but I believe he only met with Roosevelt twice. In the capacity of vice president. Lyndon Johnson was there through a lot of the presidency. In fact, in all the major meetings, except for one surrounding the Cuban Missile Crisis, Lyndon Johnson was part of the caucus, part of the those who were advising President Kennedy. But at the same time, because Bobby Kennedy had such an outsized presence in the Kennedy administration, was his, without question, his brother's closest advisor, Lyndon Johnson, as a consequence, was put to the side. And if it were up to Bobby Kennedy, would have been cast out altogether.
Yeah. Well, and one of the parts of Johnson's portfolio was NASA, which becomes a huge metaphor. I think, you know, a lot of the times when people think about JFK, they think about his inauguration, they think about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and often they'll also think about this concept of moonshot, right? And this Kennedy going out, the Soviets obviously are in the lead in space. They're putting men into orbit. America feels behind. It's you know, it's dangerous to be second in a race like that, in the technological implications. And he almost wills us to the moon, right? I mean, it's just an amazing kind of example of his vision for the future.
Yeah, he goes to Rice University and makes this rousing speech about why the moon is important to us. We choose the moon, he says. We choose to go to the moon. This is what Americans do. And it's a stunning example of how a president can use the bully pulpit to get Americans rallied around him. As I mentioned, he did that so effectively in his inauguration speech, but he does so really well at Rice University too. And he tells Americans why it matters to go to the moon at that moment. But as you point out, Tony, he has Lyndon Johnson working behind the scenes to make the dream become a reality. Lyndon Johnson had been a proponent for the creation of NASA while he was Senate Majority Leader, working with the Eisenhower administration after Sputnik went out, increasing fears among Americans that the Soviets would dominate space and would have this technological advantage over us. So when Kennedy becomes president, it is very clear that the Soviets are ahead in the space race, and we have to leap forward. And so when he says we choose to go to the moon and says that we will do so before the end of the 1960s, that is an incredibly bold promise to the American people. And Kennedy should get due credit for it. He's really putting himself out on a limb there because he knows at that point the Soviets are way ahead of us. And he doesn't know at that point how we're going to leapfrog them in order to gain advantage with our space program. One of the things that Lyndon Johnson tells Kennedy is that we can do it. He looks into this issue and comes back with a comprehensive memo that says, you know what? We can do it. We can send a man to the moon if we take these steps. And John F. Kennedy sounds the message to the American people and the world.
Yeah, and those steps are pretty consequential. I remember when I was reading through your book, $28 billion invested and literally hundreds of thousands of employees and contractors who made that happen, right?
This is a big deal. You know, this is, we hear about the moonshot today around cancer. It was that daunting to get to the moon, just as it's daunting to cure cancer, which is so formidable, so intractable ostensibly. It was that daunting for us to go to the moon. And if you look at the failed space shots from NASA to that point, you realize how truly courageous it was for Kennedy to say that it was even remotely possible for America to get there first.
Yeah, I want to go. I want to nerd out a little bit. Presidential Foundation in history with you. In the process of researching this book, were there any specific papers or speeches or artifacts that gave you chills? So just to give you an example here at the Reagan Library, you know, anytime I'm in the room or I see, you know, the actual Reagan diaries that he wrote in the evenings when he was president, it gives me the chills. It's a consequential piece of history, right? We did an exhibit on Lincoln and one of Lincoln's stovetop caps was here. And it's just, you know, you just feel different. When you work in the field of presidential history, I think there are some things that just feel truly special to be around. Was there anything like that that you came across when you were doing your research?
You know, you're so right about that. And that's the value of presidential libraries. The fact that you can go into the reading rooms of a presidential library and you can access the record firsthand and see this, you know, see the diaries, see the papers, see the speeches. That's incredibly advantageous for an historian to understand the moment contemporaneously. But one of the things that really sent chills down my spine, Tony, was I was at the home of Doris Kearns Goodwin and her husband, Dick Goodwin, had been a speechwriter for John F. Kennedy, would go on to be a speechwriter for Lyndon Johnson, perhaps the most important speechwriter of the 1960s. And I stumbled on a speech by John F. Kennedy that he was to give in Austin, Texas, on the evening of November 22nd, 1963. Of course, he had been assassinated that day in Dallas, but he was supposed to come to Austin for an event to close out that day. And reading the text from that speech where Kennedy is once again rallying America on that day, it was incredibly stirring. And that's how I end the book, with the words that John F. Kennedy was supposed to have spoken the day that would go down in infamy, November 22nd, 1963.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to you on the idea of legacy, right? And legacy is something we work in, whether you work at a historical institution, a presidential library. It's something we're very much concerned with. And there's, you know, this notion that you try to get it right. If you had your druthers and you were told to kind of summarize, what should the legacy of President Kennedy be? What should an audience in 2022 look to President Kennedy for? What do you think that is?
You know, I think he was a deeply flawed man in certain ways, and I certainly don't skirt around that issue. John F. Kennedy had his flaws. He had his personal flaws, and he had his flaws as a politician as well. But ultimately, that grace, that equanimity, edge out the recklessness of his character to become the better part of who John F. Kennedy is in the most important years of his life, those when he held the White House for just under 3 years. And we see that incomparable grace, that equanimity come to bear, as I mentioned, in moments like the Cuban Missile Crisis, but other moments too. I'll mention just one of them, if I may. And that is, we talked about the civil rights movement playing out during the course of Kennedy's presidency and it dominating the news during certain patches of Kennedy's presidency. And civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King, pushing Kennedy to do more and more and more. And you see Kennedy's reluctance to do so until finally in the early summer of 1963. I mentioned that moment where George Wallace stands in the doorway of the University of Alabama to prevent the integration of African Americans into the student body. And at that point, Kennedy has had enough. And he says, you know what, I'm going to make a speech. I'm going to go on television tonight, because he didn't want Wallace dominating the news. Again, here's the power of television, right? You only had three networks at the time. So if a president goes on, makes a speech, it's a big deal. But he does so without having a speech ready. His speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, said, I can't be ready by that time. But Bobby Kennedy, who, as I mentioned, is John F. Kennedy's closest advisor, says, just speak from your heart. So two-thirds of the address that John F. Kennedy gives on that night about the importance of civil rights come from his heart. They're expressed extemporaneously by Kennedy. And he elevates civil rights for the first time as a moral cause. And that's a big moment forward for the civil rights movement and the American people writ large. As he says, this is not just an issue of law. This is an issue of morality. No president had done that before. And in so doing, essentially puts forth the Civil Rights Act of 1963, which Kennedy didn't have the muscle or political capital to push through, but which Lyndon Johnson would push through in 1964 using the martyrdom of John F. Kennedy. So ultimately, we see that as a direct result of the courageous speech that John F. Kennedy makes in 1963.
Yeah, I found that that speech, and I didn't know that about that speech, but I found it a curious corollary to the, you talk about the I Have a Dream speech and the improvisational nature of probably the most famous part of that speech, the I Have a Dream, where these two very consequential, you know, the first time a president had put civil rights front and center as a moral issue, and you talk about how it wasn't because of the polls. He didn't look at the polls and go, hey, this is an issue I'm going to win on, I should do it. It was actually not an issue that polled all that well and was costing him some popularity, but he felt it was the right thing to do. And then on the other hand, you have Martin Luther King coming to Washington as part of the March on Washington with his assigned 8-minute speech that obviously went over and became arguably the most famous speech in the history of the United States. But also similarly improvised to these, you know, kind of concepts of justice and what's right, articulated without being pre-written. It's just kind of an amazing corollary between those two speeches.
You know, you're exactly right. And it's amazing to think that Martin Luther King was given just 8 minutes to sound his message about civil rights during the March on Washington in August of 1963. He gets up on the platform, Martin Luther King, and he starts giving this planned speech. And it's good, but it's not great. And then somebody in the King contingent yells out, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. In various speeches that Martin Luther King made in Baptist churches throughout the South during the course of the Civil Rights Movement, he talked about this dream, that his children would be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And this elaborate dream that he had that essentially amounted to full equality for all Americans under the law. And so at that point, he begins, essentially the speech becomes a cut and paste job. He's cutting it from speeches that he has made before, just directly from his heart. And he pours out his soul to the American people. And that's how we get that famous I Have a Dream speech.
Yeah, I thought it was a nice moment where you talk about after having given the speech, Kennedy greeted the folks who had been part of the speakers at the march, and Martin Luther King walks in and JFK just kind of looks at him and goes, I have a dream, and shakes his hand. It was just a very interesting moment, because I know he had some reservations, at least initially, about Dr. King and what his purpose was in kind of leading that, right?
You know, I think you're exactly, he had reservations about the movement that King was waging. He thought it was going to compromise the foreign policy vision that he had. It would show the world, and in particular the Soviet Union, that we're not a stable country, right? That we had this racial unrest. And as long as that remained on the front page of the newspaper, that the Soviets could say, you know what, you don't have a better system than we do. So that he was not encouraging of the civil rights movement. In fact, quite the contrary, he was discouraging of the civil rights movement, as was Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General. And when the March on Washington is being planned, John F. Kennedy asks the civil rights leaders who put it together not to do it. He's afraid there's going to be unrest. He's afraid it's going to end badly. And in fact, just the opposite happens there. It ends magnificently, particularly with the rhetoric of Martin Luther King. And as you said, Kennedy is watching very, very eagerly at the White House. He has great interest in what happens there that day. And as King is making the speech, he said, well, this guy's really good. And when he comes to the White House with the other civil rights leaders who participated that day, including John Lewis, he shakes his hand and says, I have a dream, commending him, tipping his hat to Martin Luther King. And that's a pretty major tip of the hat from John F. Kennedy, this great speechmaker himself, to Martin Luther King.
Yeah. Are there any new kind of nuggets that you hadn't seen before that you uncovered in your research that you think your readers might find interesting in the
book? You know, a few, Tony. One is are those papers of Dick Goodwin, which Doris Kearns Goodwin was kind enough to share with me. So there are a few nuggets from those. Also, there was one of my dear friends was Hugh Seide. Hugh Seide was the great president watcher for Time magazine, covered every president from John F. Kennedy through George W. Bush. In fact, he was a good friend of Ronald Reagan's. Ronald Reagan had enormous respect for Hugh Seide and vice versa. And Hugh became a dear friend of mine when I was at Time magazine. We did a program together called Time and the Presidency. And so I was able to look at some of the records of Hugh's time at Time magazine and use some of those. I was also able to talk to Hugh. I mean, Hugh died in 2004, but I took notes around some of the conversations that we had. And he knew John F. Kennedy probably better than any president he had covered. In fact, there was a very memorable scene where Hugh was with Kennedy on one of those 13 days of the Cuban Missile Crisis. They went skinny dipping in the White House pool, and Hugh had a wonderful anecdote about that. But those insights into John F. Kennedy during those very perilous moments from Hugh Seide, who was there, really helped me understand Kennedy a little better as well.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time, and I want to give you a chance for everybody who's watching. One final appeal. Why should they get this book, and then where can they go get it?
Well, you can get it anywhere that fine books are sold. But I think that, again, this is the book. I've read a lot about John F. Kennedy. What I didn't really get from those books was just a really crisp, dramatic narrative take on what this presidency looked like and what it means, particularly in the light of 2022. And I wanted to be riveted. And I saw that there are some great books about John F. Kennedy, including one by Hugh Seide, who wrote a book while Kennedy was in office that was published right afterward. But I think we needed a little perspective on the Kennedy presidency. And I think by the light of 2022, I have that perspective. And I think I was able to give a really dramatic narrative take on what this presidency was and what it means today.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed reading it tremendously. I thought it was a beautifully written book. It was a really great way to tell the story. You know, it's not a polished up kind of, you know, on high presentation. It's a real presentation of what he did right, what he did wrong, where he was imperfect, where he had moments of incomparable grace, as the title says. So I enjoyed reading it tremendously. I hope that everyone who's watching this goes out and gets a copy. If you're interested in the presidency, if you're interested in John F. Kennedy. So, Mark, I want to thank you for the gift of this book to the presidential history kind of trove of books that are out there, and commend you for having done such a really remarkable job in putting this all together.
Well, listen, thank you so much, Tony, and thanks for a delightful conversation. I love going to the Reagan Library and look forward to seeing you next time I'm there.
Oh, absolutely. You're welcome anytime.
Signed copies of Incomparable Grace can be purchased through the Reagan Library Museum Store. Every purchase you make from our catalog, website, or museum store is a critical component to our success. In short, your purchase supports our efforts to extend the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. Purchases can be made at reaganlibrary.com/store. To find a listing of all upcoming events, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.